yesteryear.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. With President's Day being observed during the month of February, I do have a presidential story I want to share with you, and this is submitted by Steve Patchkey, and it's titled, My Dad, JFK, and Me. I can still remember the sound of my father's voice the night John F. Kennedy was elected president. Dad was a Dust Bowl farm boy from Texas who ran away to join the Navy at 17. With a deep backwoods drawl, he explained to me how much courage and bravery it took to stand up for our country, the country he loved, and how hopeful he was of our new president, JFK. Who was JFK? What was a president? I was 5 and didn't understand. All I cared about was playing horsey. I rode on my father's back wearing my Texas cowboy hat and lugging a cap gun rifle. When he tucked me in that night, his heavy hands gently brushed back my hair and he whispered, "Sleep tight, son of mine." When I was 6, a Navy chaplain knocked on our door. My mother screamed the moment she saw him. I ran and hid inside my father's closet, breathing in the scent of pipe tobacco and aftershave from his dress blues. He was laid to rest in that same uniform at the National Cemetery in Arlington. My mother thought it best for me not to go. I didn't understand why he was dead or what Arlington was. When I was 7, President Kennedy was assassinated in Texas by a man whose rifle was more than a toy. The president was buried in Arlington, half a block from my dad. I watched the president's young son, called John John, on our black and white television as he saluted his father's casket. He was younger than me, and I couldn't understand why his mother let him go. Everything I wanted to see, he got to see. He was there for the 21-gun salute, the horse-drawn procession, the flag-draped coffin. When I was 12, I found a flag in the garage folded in neat triangles over and over 13 times. It looked like something I wasn't allowed to touch. In the bright sunshine of our backyard, I unfolded, unfurled, and let that flag fly. It felt good and clean and free. When she caught me, my mother accused me of losing my mind. I think maybe I had. I didn't understand then the magnitude of what I had found and what I had lost. My father died at the age of 44. When I reached 44, I was nervous the whole year, but I wasn't the one who died. It was John John. He died in a plane crash, just like my father. John F. Kennedy Jr.'s death, like the death of my father and his father, felt senseless to me. The reasoning for such tragedy eluded me. The night I heard the news, I walked through my half-dark house to the wall where a photo of my father hangs. It was taken a month before the crash. In the photo, he was wearing his full dress uniform, and he looked hopeful. Like the president gliding along in his parade, he had no idea what dangers were aiming for him around the corner. Beside the photo hangs a framed letter of condolence signed by then-Vice President Lyndon Baines Johnson, who rode in the motorcade 2 cars behind Kennedy on that fateful day. A flag in a triangular case, the same flag I found in the garage, hangs in a place of honor next to the framed photo and letter. Often on quiet nights like this, my father's words return to me. I can almost feel his voice, deep and measured, as he tries to explain the meaning of courage, bravery, and defending what you love, words that were far beyond my short grasp at age 5. His heavy hands brush back my hair as the tired little boy in me strains so desperately to understand. I touch the photo, I touch the flag, and I whisper, "Sleep tight, father of mine." Since we also observe Valentine's Day in February, I've got some love stories that I want to share with you. The first one, Old Love Letters and a Second Chance. And this is submitted by Shirley Kelly. In 1957, I met a young soldier who was stationed at Donaldson Air Force Base in Greenville, South Carolina, my hometown. William A. Kelly, or Bill, was 21 years old and I was 17. He told me he was 19, and I believed him. I was a junior in high school, and if my parents had known that he was older, they would not have let me date him. We met on a blind date. Actually, he was dating my friend Peggy, who had asked me to go on a date with Bill's friend. We went to a movie at the Carolina Theater in Greenville. As we stood in line, I noticed Peggy's date. He was tall and handsome with beautiful blue eyes. He smiled at me, and I immediately knew that I wanted to know this guy better. We were attracted to each other, and he sat next to me in the theater. About 2 weeks later, we were dating. Bill drove a 1956 melon red convertible. With other friends, we had a lot of fun in that car. The A&W restaurant with curb service was a place for young people in that era. We sat in cars or stood outside them, talking, joking, and having fun. We also had fun playing miniature golf. Putt-putt golf was popular in the 1950s. We went to a Baptist church every Sunday morning and went swimming in a waterhole in Rocky Creek. A lot of time was spent on front porches. Bill and I dated from 1957 until November 1958. We were happy, and he had said at one time that when we married, we would go to Germany, which was a beautiful country. Then I met someone else. I became really confused. I had to choose between Bill and a guy named Buddy. A decision was made, and I chose Buddy. I lost contact with Bill that year, and later in 1959, I married Buddy. We had two beautiful children, but our marriage failed. After 12 years, we divorced. Years passed, I raised my children, and I had a good job as a lab technician. I was in the dating game for a while, but that didn't work for me. In 2000, I began planning my retirement. I sold my home and built a smaller home near my daughter. When I began packing, taking boxes out of the attic that had been there for a long time, I found one box with yellowed paper and faded pictures, letters, and old Christmas cards. I found several letters written to me in 1957 and 1958. Wow, I had long forgotten these letters from Bill Kelly. Over the years, I had often wondered what had happened to Bill. Once I saw a man walking in Greenville who looked a lot like him. I followed him through the mall, but when he turned around, it wasn't Bill. I read the letters and felt so sad. I went down memory lane, remembering my first love. It seemed a lifetime had passed. I realized that I had chosen the wrong man in 1958. These letters were over 45 years old, and for some reason, I had kept them. Two friends that I grew up with had married guys from Donaldson Air Force Base. I called them and suggested we find people we knew in 1957 to 1958 and have a reunion. We used computers, made personal phone calls, and found a few people who were interested. But I could not find William Kelly. I found a lot of Kellys with that name, but not him. Finally, a friend of Bill's, Steve McGee, found a telephone number for Bill's brother in Watertown, New York. I called the brother, Jack Kelly, who gave me a lot of information in about 5 minutes. His brother Bill lived in Dayton, Ohio, and had made a career in the Air Force. His wife Jenny had passed away, and they had 5 children. Jack said that he remembered Bill dating a girl in South Carolina. Of course, he gave me Bill's phone number. I was really nervous. Should I call or let one of my friends call? What if he doesn't remember me? I made the call and dialed the wrong number. Oops, I tried again, and he answered. We talked for 3 hours. 3 weeks later, he visited me in South Carolina. We had a wonderful reunion with folks we had not seen in a long time. In 2004, Bill and I married in our church, Ebenezer United Methodist, in Greenville, South Carolina. During the first 10 years of our marriage, we traveled all over the good old USA and Canada. The beautiful love letters that I found 45 years later brought us together. I thank God every day for the last 18 years we have spent together, and I hope for many more. The next story I want to share with you is submitted by Douglas Clark, and it's titled, Candy Hearts Did the Trick. A cold February East Tennessee wind blew down from the snow-capped North Mountain, causing me to shiver. My younger brother, Buddy Earl, followed close behind, complaining, as always. "We better do a little running," Buddy moaned. "If we don't get a move on, we are going to freeze in our tracks." I didn't say a word. I was 13 years old, and Buddy Earl was 12. This would be our first time going to the community Valentine's Day dance without our parents. From behind me came another drawn-out groan. "Why don't we just turn around and go home? The old school gym is going to be colder than an icebox." I stopped dead in my tracks and turned around. "Listen, little brother, this is the only time Mama won't be eyeballing us and asking questions we don't want to answer." Buddy Earl pulled his coat collar a little higher and frowned. "You can't fool me. You're going because you hope little Miss Sandra Miller will make eyes at you. I can tell you right now, she won't give you the time of day." I took a small box from my pocket. "When I give her this, you'll sing a different tune." Buddy pointed to the box. "If that don't have chocolate-covered cherries in it, she ain't going to look at you twice." I smiled and took off the top. "Take a gander at these. They taste better and have words on them." My understanding brother laughed. "Did you fall out of a tree on your head? Those are just candy hearts with stupid words like, 'Will you be mine?' 'Hug me,' and 'Crazy for you.' Brother, forget about it. You don't stand a chance. Why don't we just eat the candy now?" I quickly closed the box. "It won't hurt to try. Maybe she likes candy hearts." Buddy wouldn't let well enough alone. "Remember, you won't be the only boy at the dance with a box of candy, but you will be the only one with stupid candy hearts." Suddenly, I remembered Ronnie Johnson, and my dream world tumbled down around me. He was the new boy in school who had everything, and all the girls swooned when he passed by. Maybe eating the candy would make me feel better. It sure would work for Buddy. As I approached the school gym, I stopped and turned to walk back home. Buddy Earl placed his hands on my shoulder. "Where do you think you're going? We just got here." "I guess you're right about the box of candy and dancing with Sandra Miller," I answered. "I have a better chance of flying to the moon." Buddy crossed his arms. "Big brother, do you think I walked all the way here just to turn around and go home? I'm going to stuff myself full of cookies, cake, and Kool-Aid. Then before I leave, I'm going to stuff my pockets with candy." At long last, Buddy Earl and I saw eye to eye. He was looking for sweet candy, and I was looking for a sweet girl. After entering the gym, Buddy Earl made a beeline to the tables piled high with sugary treats. As for me, I walked around the gym searching for the girl of my dreams. Suddenly, Sandra appeared, like a beacon in the night. She was surrounded by her friends, and as I approached, all the girls giggled. Sandra smiled slightly. Just her smile sent my head spinning. Sandra's light brown, long page boy hairstyle fell about her shoulders and curled under. Being the cutest and nicest girl in our school, what would she think about a small box of heart candy? Suddenly, Ronnie Johnson emerged from a group of boys and stepped around me. In his hand, he held the prettiest box I had ever seen. The box was wrapped in pink paper covered with red hearts. Now I didn't have a chance. As he gave the girl of my dreams the Valentine gift, He glanced back at me and smiled. She took the box, smiled, and thanked Ronnie. As for me, it was all over except for the long walk home. When I turned to leave, Sandra's soft voice sounded behind me. "Douglas Clark, are you not going to say hello or ask me to dance?" I almost fainted when she came near and held out her hand. "Don't be so bashful, Douglas," she smiled. "Ask me to dance." It was now or never. I took the small box of heart candy from my pocket and gave it to her. "It's not much," I said, but it comes from the heart." She placed both boxes on the bleachers next to her best friend. We stepped onto the gym floor together. Thank goodness the song was "Only You" by the Platters. After the song ended, we walked to the bleachers and sat down. Sandra opened the box of candy I had given her, took one out, and handed it to me. The heart read, "Are you for me?" How did a country boy with a small box of candy win the heart of the cutest girl in school? I don't know either, but that's just how things happened back in the good old days. And the last love story I have for you is titled First Love and a Life Lesson, and this is submitted by Shane Kays. Being 10 years old and living in a small Missouri town in the mid-1960s, my life was pretty darn good and carefree. Bowling Green was a very friendly town, kind of like the Mayberry of Missouri. I seemed to have something of a weekly routine. 5 days of school, Friday nights at the State Movie Theater, Saturday afternoons at the park, and Sundays reserved for loading up the family wagon to go visiting family. One particular Friday night, I was meeting my pals, Rick, Mike, and Ed, at the picture show. Who knows what was showing? We were probably going to just act up, talk, and pay no attention to the screen anyway. Well, on this particular Friday night, it seemed the whole fifth grade class was at the show, including one cute little blonde classmate named Cheryl. I had been vying for her attention for weeks with only moderate success, but I had a rival with the same intentions. He was richer, taller, and much more popular than I was, a lethal trifecta of ammunition aimed at thwarting my chance for everlasting love. But I had one advantage. I was friends with her best friend, Candy. So with a little encouragement and nudging from Candy, when the house lights dimmed and Leo the Lion roared to open the show, it was me who was sitting next to Cheryl, hoping to impress her with my charm and wit. My plans quickly melted away when I was faced with the fact that I had never been alone with a girl before, at least not with one that I liked, who was so cute and smelled so darn nice. Instead of being James Bond smooth, I was more Dudley Do-Right goofy. I was too nervous to speak and too shy to even share my popcorn. But by the movie's end, some of the Dudley had faded and a little of the Bond, James Bond, had emerged. We were talking, sharing an armrest, and actually touching elbows as the credits rolled, all major victories in the war of young love. My bold romantic moves did not go unnoticed by my rival. He was waiting outside after the movie ended to dissuade me from any further attempts to steal his girl. Some unpleasantries were exchanged. There was some minor shoving, shouting, and finger-pointing, and a few veiled threats were thrown about. But it was all show and no go. I think we were both glad there were enough friends keeping us apart that we didn't have to prove how untough we both really were. All in all, it was a good night. I had overcome some of my shyness with girls and had made an impression, however fake, on some of my classmates that I was a tough guy. On Saturday afternoon, I was at the park waiting to meet up with my buddies again. I heard someone yelling and turned to see three guys headed my way. I didn't know them personally, but I knew who they were. They were in the next grade higher and were friends with my rival. From the tone of their voices, it was clear that they were not coming to ask me to play baseball. They were there to inflict bodily damage on behalf of my rival. To be fair, I never knew if he had actually called out these three goons on me or if they just heard me call him Waffle Ears during our scuffle the night before. Things heated up quickly and naughty words started flying. I didn't know how many of them it was going to take to whoop my behind, but I knew how many there were going to use. Now, standing up for your right to court for the affections of a cutie such as Cheryl was certainly worth fighting for. However, it was not worth dying for. So, being confronted with 3-1 odds and discretion being the better part of valor, I decided to make like a jet and fly. I said to myself, "Feet, do your stuff," and down the hill I ran. I remember not feeling too proud of myself for running, but being outnumbered and the sound of footsteps running behind me kept me going toward Court Street. I finally turned just enough to see that there was only one guy chasing me and thought to myself, "Heck, I can take just one." I stopped and turned to hold my ground and get it on. Well, this dude pulled a slide job on me that rivaled Ricky Henderson's best slide into second base. He took the legs right out from under me. By the time I regained my stance, he was fleeing back up the hill to his posse. I remember walking the rest of the way home feeling much better about myself. I guess the moral of this story and the life lesson I learned young is this. If you are running away from something, literally or figuratively, you have to stop every now and then to look back at what you are running from. It may not be as bad as you think. And next, I have a story submitted by Helen Atkins, and it's titled Furs for the Family. I was number 12 of 12 children. By the time I was born on July 25, 1933, there were still 6 kids at home. Times were hard in the 1930s. Dad was a bricklayer, and as there was no work for him in the winter, he would do odd jobs. Plus, he hunted and trapped fox, mink, groundhog, muskrat, and other animals for their fur, and in some cases, for their meat. Dad could hunt and shoot animals and set traps. He checked his traps twice a day, no matter the weather. If he caught any animals, he brought them home, skinned them, and then stretched the skins on a frame to dry right away. It was a job that couldn't wait until later. Dad was so good that he could skin an animal and never nick the hide. Granddad Andy Thomas started to teach Dad to do all these arts when he was 8 years old. When Dad hung the furs on our house, word spread fast, and our neighbors would come to see what he had caught. After Thanksgiving, Dad would remove the pelts from the frame and turn the fur inside out. We would go to the furriers and sell them so there was money for Christmas and other needs. At Thanksgiving and Christmas time, men in our community held shooting contests to win a turkey and ham. Participants bought tickets for so much money per bullet and were limited as to how many bullets they could buy. Dad and my 3 brothers, Walter, Howard, and Everett, were excellent marksmen. One time they walked in and a man said, "Here are the Thomases. Give them their ham and turkey and let them leave." For less than $5, they each won a turkey and a ham. When they got their meat, they wouldn't try for more. They didn't think it was fair to the other men. Mom would add her canned food to our holiday meal, so we had quite a feast. Every fall, we would go to Weldy's Orchard and buy 4 bushels of apples to eat and to can to add to our stockpile of canned food. When Everett was in Belgium during World War II, he asked Mom to send him some squirrel meat. She fried it, put it in 2 glass quart jars, and poured in boiling grease to cover the meat. It arrived in perfect condition. Evelyn Rona submits a story called No Germs Allowed. No germs allowed. This was the rule of the house. If anyone under our roof dared to come down with some illness, there was an arsenal of remedies ready and waiting to engage the enemy in germ warfare. We all knew that at some point during the winter season, we would be visited by that invisible enemy that infiltrated our line of defense. Nevertheless, Mom saw to it that some preventative measures were put into place. Every day began with a glass of cod liver oil mixed with orange juice. The oil rose to the top and the orange juice sank to the bottom. There was a trick to drinking this concoction. Close your eyes, hold your nose, and get it down as quickly as possible. Inevitably, the winter season was never free of the dreaded cold germ. Dr. Mom had everything we needed for healing right at her fingertips. There were a few permanent occupants of the medicine cabinet, Vicks vapor rub, cough syrup, and aspirin to help ease symptoms. But when things got serious, the big guns came out. Raw garlic sandwiches. Of course, we took the old standby, tea with honey, lemon, and a little wine. It's a lucky thing that we were such a hardy bunch and survived one cold season after another. The battles were fought valiantly, but in the end, nature took its course and remained the winner despite all the efforts that Mother could dream up. Of course, the exceptions to treatment by Mom's remedies were broken bones and serious cuts. But along with her endless pot of chicken soup and dedication to her family, she pretty well had most situations under control. From things my parents used to say, if she got hurt when she was little, Louise Baker of Newtown, Connecticut, remembers her father used to say, "Why'd ya, cut ya, burn ya?" Her father's saying would make Louise laugh and forget about her pain for a minute. Being raised by two parents who were teachers, Barbara Palmer of Dayton, Ohio, and her siblings didn't stand a chance when it came to using proper grammar. Whenever they would ask their mother, "Can I go out to play?" or "Can I have a cookie?" she would often respond, "You can, but you may not." Their father also had a favorite correction and would remind them that there is no R in Washington. Victor Hugo once said, "The greatest happiness of life is the conviction that we are loved. Loved for ourselves, or rather loved in spite of ourselves." We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
Howdy, folks.
Yes, it is your old friend Singin' Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?